Getting to know you. Getting to know all about you.
You ready?
Getting to like you. Yes.
I think you are ready.
I am.
Welcome to What in God's Name. She is Shana Appel.
And he is Chris Owen.
Our mission is to promote and practice conversations that use the lenses of moral philosophy, humanistic theology, and basically humanistic modes of inquiry, modes of focus into our shared common life.
Yes, in fact, that is what we do, Chris. I'm glad you agree. Yes, it's a good thing that we have a mutual understanding of what we do here. We do this in order to get ourselves past to break free, of the chains of economics and politics that unnecessarily bind so much of the conversation that happens today in the public square, but which really does very little to help us get to a place of human flourishing. It really, ultimately, in our experience, and it seems in many of yours as well, that the nature of the conversation as it stands today is doing way more to divide us than to bind us or help us find common ground.
We have a spinny wheel. We give it a spin. It has 16 different core values and key ideas. The pointer is a sprinkler head. Whatever it lands on, we do a little riff. It's a little limber up, warm up that we do. We have no idea what it's going to land on. Shana, I think it's your turn to give that thing a spin.
I think you're right, Chris.
Shana, it's landed on the project of persuasion.
Of course it has.
Of course it has.
Of course it has.
So that phrase, I became familiar with that phrase in a conversation earlier this fall with Joseph Minnick when we were talking about the moral foundations of democracy, our theme for this program year. And the project of persuasion is an understanding of how democratic polity, democratic self-rule operates, which is if we're going to be self-governing people, we have to be committed to giving reasons for the positions we hold on public questions. So it's certainly related to politics, but it's not necessarily contained by political life. And the project of persuasion, I mean, the opposite of the project of persuasion would be, I suppose, the project of domination, where you simply assert how things ought to be and try to eliminate dissent.
And it would seem to me, I don't know if it was contained in the initial vision of that project, that another part of that is for people who want to participate in a democratic society, we have to be open to hearing positions that are not our own and open to the willingness, be willing to move one's position or to accept at least that there are going to be times when our positions will change, that's kind of a part of being human and a part of being part of a democracy. Situations change, life situations change. We have access to more data, more experiences that might, if we're open to it, will change how we view something.
Yeah. And the other thing, I mean, generally when we do the spinny wheel, one of us goes and then the other goes and then we're done. But I have one more rejoinder, which is there's a to exercise one's self within the project of persuasion in just the way you described, apropos of our project and podcast, there are certain kinds of virtues that are called upon from a citizen who is engaged in the project of persuasion. I understand it. I mean, there are different ways to understand this, but to me, the notion of virtue, there's a moral outlook about what is good, what ought to be normative for people who are engaged in the project of persuasion.
From a somewhat conservative platform.
Well, that is
that
so.
That would hold that there are moral absolutes, yeah. Right? And again, we come back to the need for that balance between moral conservatism and liberalism. Yeah.
Lovely. Okay, time to hold on. Let me ring the bell. That sound indicates that we have come to the end of this portion of our show, the spinny wheel portion, and we're to move on to the topic of today.
Speaking of the power of persuasion,
yes.
I want to recommend to all of our listeners a YouTube video called This is the Moral Earthquake. It's by Rabbi Sharon Brous, I think is how she pronounces her name, Brous. It was recorded on September 25th of this year, 2023, at a Yom Kippur service in Los Angeles, California. The recording can be found at ikar.org. That's ikar.org. And my stepdaughter, Amelia, sent me this recording, and I was blown away the first time I heard it. In large part because as a cultural Jew, here was a Jewish voice speaking something about the current mess in the Middle East that not only made sense, but didn't feel like absolute propaganda, that was so deeply rooted in the Yom Kippur practice of atonement and talking about really how difficult atonement can be. I'm not a person who does well with the, what's the word I'm looking for? Maybe domestication of faith traditions. I'm more the Annie Dillard, like, you know, what the hell are we doing on a Sunday morning here? We put on our bonnets and our church finest, and, you know, they ought to be handing out crash helmets in the narthex. There ought to be seatbelts in the pews. We are encountering this wild an unimaginable power beyond our earthly comprehension. So I rebel against the domestication of faith traditions, my Jewish tradition, certainly the Christian tradition, the watering down of my Unitarian Universalist tradition, any tradition. This is not about domesticating God, you know, and it's not that these faith traditions have been tried and found wanting. It's that the faith in general, has been tried and found difficult. So Rabbi Brous uses a metaphor throughout this presentation, this sermon, that is also appeals to me because I have a medical background. And she talks about a woman in her congregation who hadn't been feeling well for quite some time and was sort of ignoring the symptoms until a friend said, hey, this is serious. You need to see a doctor. I'm going to find you one. And then called her repeatedly to make sure that she set up the appointment. And thank God she did, because it turned out she had this massive tumor. It was wrapped around her spine and they had to surgically remove it. And at that point, the risk of removing it, there were risks involved, obviously, in removing a tumor of this size, particularly one that had wrapped itself around the spine, as I'm sure most of our listeners can imagine. But to not do it was going to mean death.
When you suggested that we consider this sermon for our show, you started, I think, by explaining to me this metaphor, she uses this metaphor of diagnosis, of medical diagnosis. And what I want to say, just to help our listening community, it's a metaphor. So the sermon is not about, it's not about a personal health crisis. Shana will tell you in a moment what the sermon ends up being. But this disease diagnosis metaphor becomes an entry point for Rabbi Brous to talk about issues involved in our shared common life.
And what Rabbi Brous does in the context of this sermon is kind of take us through the history of this recent movement of reactionism and nationalism and neo-messianic theology, mm-hmm. if you can call it that. It's really bad theology, but there it is, that has infected the body.
That's it, yeah.
It has infected the body, and the work that we will need to do is not dissimilar from the work of someone who finds out they have a massive tumor wrapped around their spine. We have to engage now in a treatment that is not going to be pleasant, that carries risks for sure, not the least of which is that, you know, anytime we say anything in opposition to anything happening anywhere near Israel. We stand the risk of being accused of anti-Semites. Yes, even those of us who are Jewish are often accused of being anti-Semitic by more reactionary components of our faith tradition, undermining the moral health of Judaism, undermining Israel, yes, but undermining Judaism itself. It is a phenomenal and incredibly bold sermon. I couldn't believe that she was preaching that in front of a Jewish congregation, but I guess she knows her house because there were at least two times I heard applause.
Yeah. She uses the phrase with regards to the Israeli regime, authoritative ethno-nationalist theocracy.
Yes.
I mean, not that it is, but that it can lead to that or is on the road to that or is adjacent to that. Authoritative mm-hmm. ethno-nationalist theocracy. And so...
If it helps our listeners, just frame this conversation better, because she's talking about a friend of hers who had done a tremendous amount of research after the sort of hardcore rise of right-wing nationalism and neo-Nazism here in America. And he likens these extremists with the Klan. Yeah. So if it helps our listeners to sort of frame the extremist movement that has infiltrated the government of Israel now mm-hmm. As a Ku Klux Klan in order to help clarify mm-hmm. The exceptionalism, the racism. This is a group of rabbis who want rabbinic rule to be restored. And by that, you know, you have to think of Israel slipping into a fascist state, not, as she says, not like Poland, but like Iraq.
Mm, right. The theocracy element.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Shana suggested this sermon to me, and I listened and looked at it a couple of times. It is tremendous and well worth your time to spend with it. My thought, well, Shana, let's just engage in this a little bit. I mean, my response to you was partly out of my own, like I'm not an expert in the affairs of Israel. But what struck me about this sermon is how it's transferable to things that we are living in the United States. And so that's more comfortable ground for me to engage in the conversation with you. And so one of the questions then for you and for me and for our listening community, this metaphor of diagnosis, you know, if that is appropriate, the metaphor of disease, you know, what's the disease affecting American democracy? And is it, I mean, what are the similarities to the kinds of things that Rabbi Brouse talks about? And what are some of the dissimilarities? I mean, it's not, is that a question you want to engage with? Because it's something that occurred to me as I listen.
For me, it goes back to, honestly, Pope Francis's, really, the piece of the century written about the environment. Is it Laudato Si?
Yes.
In which he talks about manifest destiny being the root of all evil.
Yeah.
And here in America, that is so much infused in our culture. It is so much a part of the ground that, well, you know, we're here and we won and we got to displace the indigenous people because God ordained it to be thus, or because we were just better suited, more powerful, smarter, you know, fill in your adjective of choice there. That in some way, shape, or form, it was ordained that white people should take over the United States of America. Now, even among liberals, I think that it's in the DNA, okay? And it informs much of our unintentional white power and privilege. In the extreme, it informs radical right-wingers like those who attacked the Capitol. It informs people like the Ku Klux Klan who then take it one step further to actually be upfront about their right to dominate based on a hierarchy of humanity, and clearly they see themselves at the top. She talked about there is an annual celebration, an annual memorial service in Israel called Yom HaZikaron. It's put on by the parent circle and combatant families, so it's made up of both Jews and Palestinians. And they share the heartbreak of war in an effort to hopefully bring people together in peace. And that service, you know, there were people giving testimony of loved ones lost, and right-wingers were outside trying to drown out their voices by honking horns. One of the people who was presenting was the sister of an Israeli Defense Force soldier. So, you know, as the rabbi puts it so succinctly, this is the relative of an IDF member who has given the full measure of devotion to their country, trying to tell his story and being drowned out by people who are so freaked out that this group of people are sharing a story of grief, that that shared story of grief is so threatening unto them that they literally have to try to drown out their voices. And when I heard that, I was thinking of, you know, the wacko so-called Baptist church here in America, out of the great state of Kansas, that was, you know, protesting the memorial services for fallen soldiers of the Iraq War. And most of us kind of scratched our heads and were like, okay, well, they're extremist and whatever. We didn't, you know, pay them a whole lot of attention. And perhaps we ought to be paying groups like that more attention, because there are common threads that bind groups like that with the January 6th insurrectionists, with those who demonstrated down in Arlington, Virginia, with those who shot up a synagogue in Pennsylvania, you know, and it goes on and on and on, that there is a germ right now swimming through the body of American democracy, and it's starting to form significant tumors. And I know it's uncomfortable to undergo chemotherapy and radiation, because I've done it. I know it firsthand, and I know that it's also terrifying. But not to do it means the certain death of the organism.
I'm glad you brought up the example of the parent circle that Rabbi Brous names, because it's an image that seared in my imagination as she was talking. So it's the parent circle. It's been going for a while, and it's just as you described. It's this time when Palestinians and Israelis come together around one circle, and it's people who have lost loved ones in this ongoing conflict. And so they do, so simple yet so profoundly powerful, is they sit and listen to the stories of grief from each other. And so the Palestinian story that was told at this particular parent circle was of a young boy who was so scared by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force soldiers coming to his house, that he ran
Majed.
And hid. Thank you. Majed. Thank you for saying his name. Yeah.
Yep.
He ran and hid, but unfortunately, I mean, tragically, he hid in a refrigerator and suffocated and died. Okay. So I go into the detail of this because
the detail is important, and because stories, you and I have talked about this, that, you know, idealistic positions don't necessarily change hearts and minds.
Right.
Stories.
Right. Right.
Stories change hearts and minds. There's a reason Jesus spoke in parables.
Right. So the parent circle is engaged in sharing these stories. And again, as you say, there are protesters outside who are trying to disrupt this process. And my question, or what I wonder about, is it possible to imagine the rage, maybe it's something different, but I'm going to say rage, that someone feels, and I'm talking about the protesters outside, the level of that rage where you are moved to try to interrupt, to stop, to prevent the sharing of grief from the people that you hate. Like there's something, there's a, and to, yeah. Let me answer my own question, I guess. I mean, in a way, this is what just occurred to me as I was framing this. I mean, it's basically an attempt to delegitimize the humanity of the one you hate.
It absolutely.
By denying the story of grief, by denying the hearing of and the taking in of the grief of the other.
I think your question started with, can we imagine the rage? Well, any of us who have been infants, no, I mean, we imagine the rage. I mean, you've seen kids throw temper tantrums before because they're not getting it their way, right? I can imagine the rage. And as a 63-year-old woman, it still comes up for me now and again. However, I'm not an infant. So, you know, I have learned to temper that, right? When I was a child, I spoke like a child. I acted like a child. At some point, you have to grow up. You're going to have rage. Certain things are going to set you off. You got to have practices for, how you'll keep a grip on your horses in those moments. Like, I don't care. It's just not allowing for or making room for the expression of that level of rage in anything other than a space designed to release rage that protects anyone from actually, you know, having it directed at them. You know, they have these rage rooms now. I've been hearing about, you just kind of go in, they give you a hammer and you break a bunch of stuff. Hey, great. I think that's probably really healthy. I think what those protesters are doing is unhealthy. And I think so antithetical to democracy, to humanity, and all that is decent, that there's no way they walk away from that situation feeling good about themselves. And if they did walk away feeling good about themselves in the moment, that over time, then there becomes something that rises, the inherent goodness, the inherent worth and dignity that rises and maybe suggests that that wasn't the best way to be. But, oh, I can't look at that. It's too painful. So I will put it down. I'll keep it buried by not only denying it, but by doing more of the thing that who was it? Was it Aquinas? The good that I would do, I do not. And the bad that I would do. You know, it is human nature. You and I have been talking about this, about the nature of sin, about our propensity to do, which is why every religion, every one of the world's great religions, and some of the less great religions, have built into them a time for Yom Kippur, a time of Lent, a time to reflect and repent, to do a vision quest, and to relocate one's true self. I mean, it's in all of the world's great religions. We must periodically go in for a physical and a full body scan and be ready to accept the results as they come up, to face them and to say, okay, well, that was to be anticipated. And now what do I want to do about that?
Yeah. I mean, that's just thinking about this parent circle. You brought it back to this metaphor of disease. I just feel like that is, it's a disease in our social body here in the United States that has gone beyond the point of seeing people with whom you disagree as opponents to being enemies. And when you cross that line, when you start seeing those people over there as enemies, then you start getting the dehumanizing ways of behaving and acting and using words too. And you've given up on the power of persuasion, just to bring it back to the spinning wheel.
To bring it back to the power of persuasion, because there's a point at which, and going back to the medical metaphor, the disease metaphor, there comes a point where, you know, cancer needs the organism to live, right? But cancer doesn't know that. All cancer knows is what it needs now. And so it will consume and consume and consume until it kills the organism. Now, once the organism is dead, the cancer that was within it also dies, but don't try to explain that to the cancer while it's consuming the organism, right? And you have the same thing. I think the clearest example of that is some of what's going on right now in the Republican Party among those who are just going to double down now around, you know, that Trump is... There was an advertisement on TV the other night. I spit a perfectly good mouthful of scotch out. Very expensive scotch, I might say. Right across my living room. It's this whole thing of, you know, Trump being this great military leader and Trump valuing our military. And it's like, does anybody forget how pissed off the military was at him because of the way he put them down, the way he undermined them, the way he absolutely trashed prisoners of war and people who were injured as losers? And they've, but no, they're going to double down on this, right? And in the process, absolutely kill the very democracy that holds their very being, the being of this country, the reason their raison d'etre, right? If they're politicians, they're destroying the very system, but they can't stop themselves.
Yeah.
So now it becomes necessary for someone, you know, for the doctor to prescribe the treatment and hope that the healthier parts of the body are still healthy enough to withstand the treatment. Which is never easy at this stage of the game. I don't honestly know, based on where we are right now, what's going to survive, if any of this is going to.
Yeah.
It's getting quite terrifying out there.
Yeah. People who...
But let me just say, yeah, Chris, yeah, this is not a time for the good cells to sit quietly.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you anticipated kind of where I was going, which is, you know... Our little project, as well as many, many others, are, you know, to extend the metaphor, right? What's the new cancer treatment? It's like immunotherapy. Right? And so you strengthen
the good cells.
You strengthen the good cells. So it's not about, interestingly, it's not necessarily about, or it's not about eliminating, in the first place, destroying the other. It's about strengthening the healthy and letting the healthy then permeate the body.
And lest anyone out there in our listening audience thinks that this patient is too far gone to be saved, I will tell you that I was in a routine visit with my own oncologist last week, Dr. Rao, at Southern New Hampshire Medical Center. She is really... quite something else. I'd say hands down the best oncologist in the state of New Hampshire, period. End of conversation, mic drop. That having been said, she told me she's got a patient who's been managing stage 4 metastatic cancer for 12 years. So lest you think for one minute that this experiment, this democratic dream is too far gone to be saved. Just remember that there is at least one person out there walking around with stage 4 metastatic cancer who's been out there walking around with stage 4 metastatic cancer for over a decade. And I think if that person can continue to hang in there and fight, so can we.
Can I ask you one more question about Rabbi
Brous? I thought that was a perfect place to end, but okay. I thought you were just going to go, wow, yeah, stay curious, go deep. Okay, yeah, ask me another question about Rabbi Brous.
So, Shana, talking about the, you know, these cancer cells floating in the body, and Rabbi Brous talks about messianic ideology married to state power and how this is not a good thing. This is not a good thing. Messianic ideology... married to state power. And so my question I wanted to explore with you, what is unsound about that? How is that going to be unhealthy? How is that going to manifest as disease and you know, maybe even death? Like so what is it about the human being that marrying those two things is just bad news?
Well, I think, again, to move from, you know, the Israeli context, which is less familiar people,
yeah,
to something in America, which may be more familiar, The equivalent would be white Christian nationalism. And what's deadly about it is that when notions of the coming of the one who will free us, the time of freedom, of the dawning of the age of Aquarius, if you will, is removed from its proper place of hope and aspiration to a place that involves guns and oppression, is when we move into a toxic realm and we begin to consume the organism, which in this case is democracy.
That's a beautiful, that's so,
I'm having a good morning. What can I say?
Well, so
a moment of clarity in an otherwise bewildering world.
No, that's true. But, so that you named very specifically and concretely what I was intuiting, you know, as I answer my own question inside myself, which is...
do you do that often,
Of course,
Chris?
I do. It's the way I operate. So the messianic hope, just understood figuratively, is this desire. I would couch it as a human desire for... for all things to be made right. And you named, I think you said hope, or but the kingdom as mm-hmm. is a phrase you use. I mean, isn't that the messianic hope or this vision? Like, if we had a Messiah, if we had a savior to come, divine or human, like, you know, when we want to be saved, I mean, think of a metaphor of your firefighting. Like, we want somebody to come in and take us out of danger,
yeah,
and save us. And they're, you know, so it doesn't have to be. We don't have to couch this in like the divine swooping in and lifting us out. Like, we have human existential experiences of wanting to be saved, right? Okay, so this
even when it has become perfectly clear that we could do this ourselves, right? And if you go back into the story of Kings, there was a perfectly healthy culture that was emerging that was egalitarian.
Yeah.
But, you know, as soon as people got freaked out and there seemed to be some disagreement, then suddenly the people decided what they really needed was to elect a king.
Yeah.
And that really begins the downfall of the egalitarian kingdom. So it may be a sort of an organic human craving, or it may be, you know, some mysterious intersection between where humanity and the divine meet, where we know it could be better. You know, like, inherently we know that it can be better. Inherently we know what's right and we know what we're called to do, but God, it's just so hard.
Yes.
So we'll do what's easy until we can't anymore. But
the marriage to state power, you said it. I think you said the word guns.
Yeah, when we yield.
But that's it. That's the disease of marrying the two, because one is, I'm calling the messianic kind of hope as a good thing. Now, messianic ideology could be something different.
Yeah.
Where it becomes a program of, here's my vision, here's my ideology of what mm-hmm. it means for us to be a saved society. And then you marry that to political power,
right.
You end up with coercion,
yes,
and violence.
And she makes the case, Rabbi Brous tells the story of this very haunting Jewish melody that, if you're Jewish, you've probably heard it since you were a kid, that was initially sung by someone on the train on the way to the gas chambers, you know, in Germany. And it was, you know, sort of a prayer. The song became sort of a prayer of hope. And I think when you're facing extinction, when you are facing genocide, when you are facing the dark night that does not seem like it will ever end, in that context, messianic hope is not only understandable, it's like laudable, right?
Yeah.
You know, to hope in the place of hopelessness. I get that, but you're absolutely right. Once it gets melded with state power and used to Yeah, the current marriage of messianic fervor and state power equal a recipe for extreme violence, use of extreme power, and self-annihilation. A society that fails to honor the image of God among some will ultimately undermine God's image in all. A society that fails to honor the image of God among some will ultimately undermine God's image in all. So once the messianic hope turns to, you know, a messianic hope for me, but not you, it starts to divide people as opposed to weave them together, then the beginning of the end is in view, and the disease has launched and now is in need of being rooted out.
And so this brings me back to the project of persuasion, which is a theological grounding of the project of persuasion, just to pick up on what you quoted from Rabbi Brous. The theological foundation is seeing the image of God in the other.
Mm-hmm. And assuming the premise that hearts and minds can and will be changed.
Yeah.
Without it, what's the point of persuasion? So.
Right. Right.
There you have it.
Right. Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light.
You've been listening to What in God's Name, the podcast of the S1 Project. We are supported here at What in God's Name and the S1 Project
by our generous donors on Patreon.
Become a generous donor on Patreon, if you will, and continue to support this vital project.
Yes, you can do that at patreon.com. Put in the search bar, What in God's Name?
P-A-T-R-A-E-O-N. Patreon.com.
Or something like that.
did I spell it right? P-A-T-R-E-O-N, Patreon.com.
Shana, thank you for this conversation. It's really been fun to dig in with you on this amazing sermon by Rabbi Brous, which we will post in the show notes. Thank you so much, Shana.
Thank you, Chris, for joining along, and thank you to all of our listeners for listening in.
That's it.
Nice.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye now.
Great to dig into that.
I hope people...
That was a-